The ink is dry. I believe what God said about sexuality and human relationships and what is holy and right as compared to that which dehumanizes us and takes us away from the purpose of God. I think that's clear in Scripture. I think the ink is dry on that. In the last 50, 60 years, a lot of people have come to think that we've misread all those texts and we've missed something. And historically, there was no precedent to the kind of relationship options that are open to people today, legality of them, ethical acceptance of them, cultural normalcy for them. None of that's true. It was far more open, pronounced, evident, approved, especially among the socially elite and the wealthy in ancient times than it has become yet, even though it's widely discussed and a subject of great controversy. So every week I'll take you back and start at this single beginning point. I will remind you that remote's working. Yeah, thanks. I will remind you that the thesis of this study is essentially positive. It's that summary statement out of Hebrews 13, marriage should be honored by all and the marriage bed kept pure. That doesn't mean everybody has to get married. Doesn't mean the married state's superior. Doesn't mean the single state's superior. Marriage is the option most people will choose, 9 out of 10 people. Marriage is honorable. And in particular, it's only within marriage, going back all the way to Genesis 1 and 2, that the male-female relationship is expressed as a one-flesh intimacy. That language is sexual language. It's not euphemistic to sort of avoid saying have sex. I think it's rather idealistic. It's more than a physiological function. It's the fusing of two personalities by virtue of the most intimate experience that humans share with each other. Marriage is honorable, and in that relationship, sex is not only honorable, it's right, it's holy, it's blessed of God, and the marriage bed is to be kept pure. And the language there is very specific about the marital bed, the one flesh intimacy there. And the negative thesis in that verse is, but, for, on the other hand, over against the honorable relationship of sexuality within marriage, God will judge covenant breakers, people who are married and don't honor their marriage commitment and keep that a one flesh commitment. Admitting a third party, whether they're married or single, you break that marriage covenant, you come under judgment. That's sin. Or sexual immorality. That's a different word. That's porneia. It means any sort of sexual congress, sexual experience, sexual intercourse outside male-female marriage. And that's whether it's male and female, male and male, female and male, or even tonight, we'll get to Leviticus 18, humans and animals. I've actually counseled people who have been involved in bestiality. It's not just an ancient, it's even a contemporary relationship some people pursue. We quit last week talking about gender identity. I want to do just a quick follow-up on that. Biblically, I know of no way to separate sex and gender. Sex is not assigned by an obstetrician, a physician at birth. Sex is read off the physiology, the body, the genitalia of the baby that's born. It's not assigned. It's not, we'll talk about social construct in a minute, that terminology. Gender, in our culture, we've separated the word gender out, and gender has to do more with one's subjective tastes, preferences, and behaviors. Biblically, I don't know how to separate those words. I don't think you can separate them biblically, but the culture does. This is a statement from the World Health Organization. Why I begin with it in a moment would be clearer. This is a statement that's been out from the World Health Organization for at least 8 years, maybe 10. Gender interacts with, but is different from sex, which refers to the different biological and physiological characteristics of females, males, and intersex persons, such as chromosomes, hormones, and reproductive organs. Okay, that's what sex is. It's the physiological, chromosomal. Gender and sex are related to, but different from, gender identity. And just so to to emphasize the point that I want to, the italicized part next. Gender identity refers to a person's deeply felt internal and individual experience of gender, which may or may not correspond to the person's physiology or designated sex at birth. In that statement, there is rooted all sorts of possibilities for confusion, and gender identity focuses on, going back to our gingerbread person, notice that the brain part, gender identity is determined here. And the mantra in gender-affirming settings or in same-sex affirming setting, transgender affirmers, is to say gender is not something that anyone can tell you except the person who tells you for himself or herself. Can't read it off their physiology, can't read it off their birth certificate. It is an identity that you choose, and then out of that choice, you express it in certain ways, sometimes more masculine, more feminine. It leads you to an attraction toward one, other, or both sexes, bisexual. And it is not directly related to male, female in terms of sex. The reason I want to go back to that for just a minute is an article appeared in the New York Times since we were together last week. Now, you know the New York Times. It's a right-wing Baptist Church of Christ conservative presbyterian. Well, maybe I'm mistaken, but anyway, this is the full article. This is a screenshot and the quotation of the first three paragraphs. Title: as kids, they thought they were trans. They no longer do. It's about gender identity. People who've chosen a different identity for their gender than their body's sex would lead them to think they might be. You need to know just a little bit of what's said here in light of the World Health Organization statement. World Health Organization is backing away from that position that it has taken, because gender-affirming studies in the Scandinavian countries, I'll give you the data in a minute, they are backing away from their eagerness to affirm what is called gender-affirming care that the American Psychiatric, Psychological, and Pediatric Associations are still aggressively affirming in this country. We were behind them starting it. They are now limiting and in some cases stopping it. We're still affirming it. My point is, scientifically, it is beginning to be questioned in the very places where it was initiated. The article begins, Grace Powell was 12 or 13 when she discovered she could be a boy. Growing up in a relatively conservative community in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that's a very conservative part. I've lived in Michigan. That's where all the evangelical churches and publishing houses are located in Grand Rapids, Zondervan, IVP. Powell, like many teenagers, didn't feel comfortable in her own skin. She was unpopular and frequently bullied. Puberty made everything worse. She suffered from depression and was in and out of therapy. We call those comorbidities, and they're very seldom discussed when you talk about transgender issues. I felt so detached from my body, and the way it was developing felt hostile to me, Powell told the writer. It was classic gender dysphoria, a feeling of discomfort with your sex. Okay, that's gender dysphoria. I'll read three more paragraphs. Reading about transgender people online, Powell believed that the reason she didn't feel comfortable in her body was that she was in the wrong body. Transitioning seemed to be the obvious solution. The narrative she had heard and absorbed was that if you don't transition, you'll kill yourself. That's a very common justification for transgender affirming persons. To say the alternative to encouraging the transitioning is people will kill themselves. The comorbidities, the studies are showing that the suicide rate is no higher among transgender people than non-transgendering kids working through that by virtue of comorbidities. That is, if they had already we're dealing with anxiety, depression, etc. This issue does not resolve it, and in fact may be the underlying cause for it. Back to the article. At 17, desperate to begin hormone therapy, Powell broke the news to her parents. They sent her to a gender specialist to make sure she was serious. In the fall of her senior year of high school, she started cross-sex hormones. She had a double mastectomy the summer before college, went off as a transgender man named Grayson to Sarah Lawrence College, where she was paired with a male roommate on a men's floor. At 5'3", she felt she came across as a very effeminate gay man. At no point during her medical or surgical transition, Powell says, did anyone ask her the reasons behind her gender dysphoria or her depression. At no point was she asked about her sexual orientation. It's hard for me to believe. At no point was she asked about any previous trauma, so neither the therapist nor the doctors ever learned that she'd been sexually abused as a child. Quote, I wish there had been more open conversations, Powell, now 23, and detransitioned. The term detransition is now in the vocabulary. You transition, say, from female to male. To detransition is to say, wait a minute. That was a big mistake. Can't correct a double mastectomy. Can't correct various kinds of surgeries that go with gender transitioning. I wish there had been more open conversations, Powell, now 23, and detransition told me, but I was told there's one cure and one thing to do if this is your problem, and this is what will help you. There is this thing that is called social contagion. That you see the news stories of a suicide in a Memphis school. What's the first thing they do? Send counselors in, because what happens with kids in school where there's a suicide? Copycatting. If you, I bet some of you have done it, and I'm not in your face about it. If you have a weird symptom, your body feels something weird, and you spend the day on WebMD and Mayo Clinic's online stuff, you'll have cancer before dark. at least you'll be convinced you do, because, I think that's it's heart disease or it's whatever. I was in Jonesboro, Arkansas, doing one of these seminars that Jason mentioned, and learned there through the person involved in it, I'm quoting an email. At a local public school, there's an extremely popular teacher who's involved in a same-sex relationship. She shares aspects of her life with her students. Her charisma and influence, along with her position of authority, has resulted in around 30 young ladies identifying now as lesbian or bisexual. These are seventh graders. The data is pretty clear. Once someone adopts this lifestyle, the chances of being in a traditional monogamous marriage declines. It's hard to watch that sort of indoctrination take place. The remainder of the article, which I will not spend more time on, it's February 2nd, New York Times. Some of you I know get the New York Times or get it online. As kids, they thought they were trans. They no longer do. It's an article about detransitioning and about the medical research that has caused some physicians and therapists in this country to say, maybe we should slow down and at least do a survey and study comparable to what has been done in the Netherlands and so on. In countries like Sweden, Norway, France, the Netherlands, and Britain, long considered exemplars of gender progress, medical professionals have recognized that early research on medical interventions for childhood gender dysphoria was either faulty or incomplete. Last month, the World Health Organization, the quote that I gave you at the beginning, in explaining why it is developing, quote, a guideline for the health of trans and gender diverse persons, said it will cover only adults because, quote, World Health Organization, the evidence base for children and adolescents is limited and variable regarding the longer term outcomes of gender affirming care for children and adolescents. if the scientists step in and begin to question it, there's hope that the culture will rethink some things. Preacher's voice doesn't mean much. Ethicist's voice doesn't mean much. Parents' voice may not mean much. But if scientists begin to say, wait a minute, we followed some of these children through the detransitioning rate. The 80 to 90% of children who experience gender dysphoria work through it in mid to late puberty with mom and dad's help and just with their own maturing. Again, how many people at 13 or 15 know what they want to do with any part of their life and what is the most complicated part of your life? It's the relationship part of your life. And to think that for a 15, a 13, an 11-year-old, that if a child says, you know, I think I'm a girl, or I think I'm a boy, or I think I want to be this, that puberty blockers and surgeries are the appropriate gender-affirming care, it seems to me naive to the point of being hazardous to everybody's health, physically, spiritually, and otherwise. We start with Genesis. In the Old Testament material, and we begin to ask ourselves, have we, as some biblical scholars are wanting to argue, have we misinterpreted all these texts for 3,500 years? The Torah, and when we get to Jesus and Paul. We start with the Sodom episode. In Genesis 19, in chapter 18, three visitors, heavenly visitors come, three angels or an appearance of the Lord himself and two angels to inform Abraham that the promise of blessing all the nations through him is going to be realized, and that Sarah is in fact going to have a child in her old age, etc. They're received with warmth and hospitality, and yeah, there's some giggling about it. Really? You know, no. By this time next year, you'll see. Well, chapter 19 picks up two of those three visitors, Abraham and Sarah, going into Sodom. They go into Sodom to warn Lot, Abraham and Sarah's nephew, who is there, his wife and their daughters, that something really bad is about to happen in Sodom and they should get out and not look back. Well, part of the story here, the two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city, and when he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed his face to the ground. My lords, he said, please turn aside to your servant's house, Eastern hospitality. You can wash your feet, spend the night, then go on your way early in the morning. No, no, they said, we'll spend the night in the town square. But he insisted so strongly that they did go with him and entered his house. He prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast. They ate. Before they'd gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. They called out to Lot, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out so we can have sex with them. King James Version says, know them. Remember that. That becomes a point in a moment. Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him and said, no, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who've never slept with a man. What kind of stooge is Lot, and what influence has there been on him to live in Sodom as long as he has? Let me bring them out to you. You can do what you want with them, but don't do anything to these men. They've come under the protection of my roof. Get out of our way, they replied. This fellow came here as a foreigner. Now he wants to play the judge. We'll treat you worse than we're going to treat them. They kept bringing pressure on Lot, moved forward to break down the door. Well, you know the story, and it's from that Sodom story that the English word sodomy derives. Well, the revisionist take on Genesis 19 is that this is really not about anything that we would call homosexual activity. It's not about same-sex lust or same-sex threat. It's about inhospitality. It is about an attempted gang rape, which would always be wrong, whether the subject is male or female, by males or females. It's their arrogant insensitivity, etc. Well, if you've heard that, and it's throughout the revisionist literature, it overlooks the fact that the judgment against Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities of the plain was not based on what happened after those two people got to town. You go back to Genesis 13. The Sodom story is in 19. You go back into Genesis 13, and it's easy to remember, verse 13. Now the people of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. Something was already going on that is the basis for judgment. You come forward into 18:20 before we get into the story in 19. The Lord said, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great and their sin so grievous that I will go down and see if what they've done is as bad as the outcry that's reached me. If not, I will know. In other words, Abraham, we need to get word to Lot and warn him because they are about to be judged. The judgment is not based on how they mistreated two guys who showed up. The judgment was based on the fact that the sins of Sodom, Gomorrah, and the plains were going up to the Lord. And the notion that if you go back to the King James Version, you actually get a truer reading, that they came to Lot's house, bring them out that we may know them. They wanted to examine their identity papers, that they were not spies from some hostile tribe or hostile group. We just want to check their credentials and find out who they really are. The word translated no is the word that very often in the Old Testament is translated no. It's the Hebrew word yada. And yada means to know in the carnal sense of having sex with. And so that you would know there is no mistaking that, in verse 8, when Lot, the stooge, the terribly negatively influenced man, says, take my daughters, it's that same word yada and no. Them. NIV translates correctly in both places. Bring the men out that we can have sex with them. Here, take my daughters, have sex with them. Same Hebrew word, yada. The issue is not they've been inhospitable. They've been rude to visitors. The issue is, well, I'll let a New Testament text tell you what the specific issue is in a moment. Don't always trust my exegesis, but if you have a New Testament exegesis of a passage, put your money on that one. Then another attempt to deal with that passage is to say, well, Ezekiel, looking back on Sodom, he doesn't talk about the episode with the men and the sexuality. Ezekiel 16:48-9, as surely as I live, says the sovereign Lord, Sodom and her daughters, those cities of the plain, were never as wicked as you and your daughters. This is part of Ezekiel's judgment against Judah for their sinfulness for which they're about to be judged. Sodom's sins were pride, gluttony, and laziness while the poor and needy suffered outside the door. David Gushee, in his book, Changing Our Mind, makes a big point of this text, camps there, and says, you see, whatever it was in Genesis 19, it had nothing to do with sexuality. It was about pride, gluttony, probably including their drunkenness, laziness, and neglect of the poor. It was interesting that he didn't read the next two verses. She was proud and committed detestable sins. And mark the word toeva, which we're going to look at in some detail in a minute. It's a word that relates to sexual sin. She was proud and committed detestable sins, toeva. So I wiped her out, as you have seen. Even Samaria didn't commit half your sins, the northern kingdom, when it was destroyed in 721. You've done far more detestable things, toeva, than your sisters ever did. They seem righteous compared to you. One just technical point, even though the word here is translated as plural, detestable sins, detestable things, the word toeva is singular. And in Leviticus 18 and the holiness code that we're about to look at, the only sins that are specified with the singular term are the sexual sins of chapter 18. Rape, adultery, bestiality, and same-sex behaviors. The full text, well, if I were ever to have been a school teacher and gave a multiple choice question, Ezekiel says, the Old Testament material says, the people of Sodom were destroyed for A, pride, B, gluttony, C, laziness, 4, neglect, or D, neglect of the poor and the needy, 5, sexual sins, and then I would probably give an F option, all of the above. What would the correct answer be? Well, it wouldn't be to pick one of these. Ezekiel has specified, it's not an either or. Is the story the way it reads in Genesis 19 really about sex? Or weren't they proud, gluttonous? Well, all of the above. It's not either or. Sins very commonly go together. Well, I said a moment ago, don't trust my exegesis. If an inspired one is given somewhere in the New Testament, trust it. Short little book of Jude, which is the hardest book of the New Testament I ever tried to read in Greek. Any of you want to read it in Greek, do it by yourself. It is work. Verse 7. If you start at verse 5, though you already know all this, I want to remind you that the Lord at one time delivered his people out of Egypt, but later destroyed those who didn't believe, children of Israel rescued under Moses. And the angels who didn't keep their positions of authority, but abandoned their proper dwelling, these he's kept in darkness and bound with everlasting chains for judgment on the last day. Apparently, Satan and the demons were once angels who misused a freedom they had for a time and were cast down. So Jude is warning against doing things that would bring judgment on yourself, like the Egyptians did in enslaving the Jewish people, like even Satan, some of the evil angels. Verse 7, in a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding towns gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion. They serve as an example of those who suffer the punishment of eternal fire. What was going on in Genesis 19 was pride. It was gluttony. It was insensitivity to the poor. But if you found any environment today where all those things are going on, I'm not trying to pick on New York or LA or Nashville, but if you find any urban area where gluttony, pride, disregard for the poor is going on, and maybe the poverty drives some to it, sexual vice, sexual immorality, sexual sin of all sorts of kind, all sorts and types, will most likely be there too. The Sodom story is what it has been read from the King James Version and other versions to be, and the knowing in the King James Version was not making sure they're not terrorists or spies. It's the same knowing that Lot offered his daughters to those men. It was for sexual favors. The story of Sodom is a story of the judgment of God against a type of behavior that begins to be dealt with in some detail in Leviticus, in the larger body of the Torah, in the Holiness Code. There is a section of the book of Leviticus, a block, 9, 10 chapters, chapters 17 through 26, that's called the Holiness Code. Holiness has to do with being set apart, right? For something to be holy, it is to be set apart for a purpose, or in this case, set apart for a person, set apart for God. And in the book of Leviticus, in the Holiness Code, man, there, you'd say, there sure is a lot of nitpickiness in there. Boy, there really is. And you start reading through it, and there are things about what you can eat, what you can't eat. There are things about tattoos. Don't use that on your kids. In these cultures, the tattoos were marks of pagan commitment to certain deities you had the deity's image tattooed on you as part of your worship. It's not, you know, my love mom. That's not what was going on. Anything that had to do with blood is talked about as being forbidden, displeasing to the Lord for it to be treated. That's where you get the kosher food laws. That's why if you eat Hebrew national hot dogs, you know, the animal has been bled much more carefully than the non-kosher dogs would be. That's why there's even this provision in here that a man and woman who are married and otherwise have right of sexual access to one another, but not during a woman's period. I don't think any of those things have to do with medical or physiological factors. Blood was sacred to the Lord. Leviticus, 17, 14, or 23? Blood is sacred to the Lord because the life of the flesh is in the blood, and therefore blood, you don't touch blood, you don't treat blood with contempt, you don't eat blood, you don't have sexual intercourse where a woman is in her period. Blood is sacred. So in 17 to 26, boy, you have everything covered from what you eat and don't eat to touching blood, or if you have a running wound or sore. Chapter 18 is about sexual behaviors. And among the other things that are, and this we'll talk about on the next slide or two, this word toiva. It's very often used in these sections in the plural that there are certain detestable things. Touching blood, eating blood, intercourse during a woman's period. These are things. Okay. The only thing that is ever called toiva singular that is detestable to the Lord has to do with the sexual sins that are prohibited in 18. And it's that singular verb, noun. It's actually a participle. It's a feminine participle. If you want the details, check it. It's a verb being used as a noun to describe something. The word detestable basically means something that doesn't please the Lord. There are a lot of things that you don't do this because it would not please the Lord. Well, in 18:22, do not have sexual relations with a man as one does with a woman. That's detestable. Somebody says, well, the Old Testament didn't say anything about a woman having sex with a man. It's not to Paul, I guess. Every prohibition that's in the Old Testament or permission or commandment that's given to a man is given to Israel. The command that a man is to pray, does that mean women or not? Until in my lifetime, I was taught in the ninth grade by Clara Doris that he is the indeterminate pronoun to use when you're writing prose. That when you talk about, unless you've named Mary Lou, that she's doing so-and-so, he does, or we didn't write one should, he should. In the biblical literature, the masculine pronouns are typically used to be inclusive pronouns. Hit the wrong button. Yeah. So what is said here about a male having relationships with another male does not mean, women having sex with other women was not prohibited. It was. It was the matter of same-sex behavior. He returns to it in 2013 and adds the penalty. And that becomes an important. If a man has sexual relations with a man, as one does with a woman, both of them have done what is detestable. That's our word again. They are to be put to death. Their blood will be on their own heads. Now, the significance of that is discounted in the following ways. Yeah, well, who wants to bother with Leviticus? We're the New Testament church. We don't have to worry with those Old Testament laws. You don't have to buy Hebrew National kosher hot dogs. I like them, by the way. That's what I'm talking about. But and if you want to eat pork, one of those things that's detestable was for a Jewish person to charge interest to their fellow Jewish people. Either on your bank or tomorrow. rare steak that hadn't been bled, whatever. All of those things might be detestable, displeasing to the Lord. But the seriousness of the displeasure, the seriousness of the detestability, or some translations, I think maybe the King James Version uses the word abomination, the seriousness of God's displeasure with the act would be measured by the penalty attached to it. What's the penalty if you touch blood, or if you have a running sore that is bleeding, or if a couple has sex during woman's period? What's the penalty? You do a ritual washing and you're unclean until the sunset of the following day. For some of them, there are washings and denials for a week. For some of them, some of the more serious ones with regard, say, to theft, it might be banishment from the community. What's the penalty? What was the penalty for same-sex relationships? They're both to be put to death. So this isn't rape. That's another of the revision. Well, this is talking about rape. At the end of a war, the defeated soldiers might be raped by the victorious soldiers. I mean, that still goes on in battles that are being fought today. Well, that's evil, all right. But there you'd have a victimizer and a victim. Here, they're both to be put to death. This is a voluntary participation by two people. And then notice the language. Their blood will be on their own heads. I mean, that's pretty strong language in Hebrew. They've got nobody to blame for themselves. They brought this on themselves by consenting to this event. So the point of that is to say, yeah, who bothers with Leviticus? Because a lot of things are chronicled there. Yeah, and a lot of them are minor. But I think, I used to wrestle with this. Why bother with those little bitty things? I wonder if it isn't there in Leviticus just to say, hey, folks, in any generation, Old, New Testament, whatever, everything about your life matters to God. There are no little things, big things. Everything, God wants you to consider how this does or does not relate to His holiness and your behavior. Well, in terms of those events that are that serious, the most serious of those events, when you get into Leviticus 18, notice the context and the setting when you begin reading at, and I'm starting at verse 20. Don't have sexual relations with your neighbor's wife and defile yourself with her. Well, that's clearly a sexual sin. That's called adultery. 21, don't give any of your children to be sacrificed to Molech. You must not profane the name of the Lord. I am the name of your God. I am the Lord. I am Yahweh. Child sacrifice, idolatry. Again, death penalty attaches. Next verse, 22. Do not have sexual relations with a man as one does with a woman. That's detestable. That's our word again. 23. Don't have sexual relations with an animal and defile yourself with it. A woman must not present herself to an animal to have sexual relations with it. That's perversion. That's bestiality is the term for that. And now watch the language beginning at 24, because this is another claim that Gushy makes in his book. All of these holiness code issues are cultic to Israel. These are unique prohibitions, probably time limited, because these are Israelite people coming into territory that has been evacuated, purged by war to drive out the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites and the Ivites and whatever. And so these are the cultic provisions for Israel. No. Beginning at 24, the very next verse. Do not defile yourselves in any of these ways, because this is how the nations that I'm going to drive out before you became defiled. These are not cultic religious demands on Israel. Well, if they're not cultic to Israel, where'd they come from? I'm coming to that. Even the land was defiled, so I punished it for its sin, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you must keep my decrees and my laws. The native born and the foreigners residing among you, it's not cultic to the people who are Jews. The foreigners residing among you must not do any of these toeva, detestable things. For all these things were done by the people who lived in the land before you, and the land became defiled. And if you defile the land, it'll vomit you out as it vomited out the nations that were before you. Reuben, if they weren't cultic and unique to Israel, where'd they come from? The character of God. Moral right and wrong are not arbitrary by decree. In other words, on the mountain, God didn't say, okay, Moses, write 30 acts that are fairly common among the folks and down at the base of the mountain, and put them in your hat and shake them up. Now pull out the first one. Telling the truth, okay, make that good. What's the next one? Fornicate, put that on. So alternate. This is good, this is bad. God could not say that lying is a good thing. Titus 1 verse 2 says it. God who cannot lie has promised so. God can't lie. God couldn't make lying a good thing. Why? It goes against God's own nature as a holy being. A thing is morally right if it goes with the grain of God's character. Truth-telling. Keeping your promises, keeping the marriage bed pure, worship, prayer. Some of those are cultic, like worship and prayer. Cultic doesn't mean you belong to a cult. It means it's part of the religious ritual. But things like telling lies or committing murder, those things aren't wrong by edict. God could not make those things right because of who God is. I use the illustration sometimes of a board. Some of you guys, some of you women maybe do woodworking. If you want to smooth a 1x12 that you're going to use to make shelving with, you want to use your plane with or against the grain. You better plane it with the grain. What will happen if you try to do it against the grain? You'll ruin it. You know, you'll gap. In my simplistic mind, I think very simply because I'm a simple soul. If something goes with the grain of God's holiness, that's something that he says, that's a good thing to do. Prayer's a good thing to do. Worship's a good thing to do. Telling the truth. Love your children. Be faithful to your husband and wife. Those things go with the grain of God. They're not right by decree. By decree, he lets us know how these acts are related to his character. And the things that go against the grain of God's character, murder and lying and covenant breaking, misuse of sexuality. Those things are wrong, not because God decided cultically Israel should or shouldn't or the church should or shouldn't, but because of who God is. And those things don't change. The moral code of the Old and New Testament is identical because God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so go through the Ten Commandments, the lying, the committing adultery, the committing murder, the stealing, whatever. Well, let's wonder, maybe the New Testament will get a break. Wait a minute. They can't change because God's the same. Basic moral, you say, well, what about the killing of people? The execution of people for sin is not murder. Murder's one thing, execution's another. Don't defile yourselves. This is how the nations I'm going to drive out before. they were violating not Israelite law. They were violating the holiness of God. That's why the Canaanites were driven out of the land. Even the land was defiled, so I punished it for its sin. The land vomited out its inhabitants. You must keep my decrees and laws. The native-born and the foreigners, these are universal moral commandments. Now, let me go back to a point that I've made and we'll make again when we get into the New Testament. There are some things that are distinctive to the cultic life, the worship ritual life, like prayer or tithing to a Jew, or in the New Testament, prayer and our non-tithing. No. And by the way, if that percentage had changed from 10% to 18 or to 7, there would have been no moral problem with that. That's not a moral issue. That's a matter of edict and decision. That's why churches have elders. They don't make decisions about moral issues. God's character decides what's right and wrong with regard to a moral issue. With regard to matters of judgment that do not affect a behavior that relates, that tells me I got 5 minutes and I better finish up, okay? Some of you know that I do that because I'm like a locomotive. I get started and I don't stop. So, sorry, had my back and trying to say, wonder which one I have up there. Before I leave the holiness code, I want to look at how the holiness code should be handled. The moral provisions of Old and New Testament. The reason why a lot of the Old Testament moral instruction is not repeated is we're going to have the whole book. The church begins and for 10 years is Jewish. They have Torah. They have Leviticus. They have the moral law. And the reason why Paul says a lot more about it than Jesus is what? He's the apostle to Gentiles. They didn't understand what God's nature required of them with regard to certain things. And as we will see next week, their moral lives, well, even to say they had a moral life is a little bit of a grace. It was life and lifestyle were wide open for them. But having said that, does that give us the right then to be mean-spirited and hateful and harsh? And the church's message to sin is, you stop that! Don't you come here to this church while you're, if you're still drinking. Don't you come here to this church if you've got marriage problems. Don't you come here to this church if you've gone through a trans process or if you're gay. I want any sinner like me to be welcome at this church. My sin is more likely to be pride that I haven't done those things. And pride, even in Sodom, was one of the sins among many that they were guilty of. And pride is one of those things that runs against the nature of God. When Jesus came and God was in the flesh, he was anything but proud and haughty. He didn't come to be served, but served. So how does Jesus handle the holiness code when it comes to the rubber meeting the road? Well, I go back to our John 8 episode. Here's the woman taken in the act of adultery. If she's caught in the act, and that's the language, there would have had to have been a male or a female partner, probably in this case a male from the way it seems to be set up. So they drag Jesus in and quote the holiness code that somebody who commits a sexual sin, they probably read from, you know, they pulled out their King James Version of Leviticus 18 and read, this is what you do. Well, okay, maybe not. Maybe they actually read in Hebrew. But they get to Jesus and they say, you know what the Torah says. You didn't stone in every case, but if it was blatant and flagrant, if it was in your face, apparently this was not terribly concealed. She's caught in the very act. She'd be subject to it. Now, in sermons, preachers have misinterpreted the text. Well, if any of you are perfect, go ahead and throw a stone. Jesus doesn't say, if anybody in this crowd has never committed a sin, you go ahead and stone her. what Jesus said. Jesus knows Torah better than they do. Here's what Deuteronomy 19 says, beginning at 15. One witness is not enough to convict anyone accused of a crime or offense they may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. They probably had, yeah, we're all witnesses. Well, next verse. If a malicious witness takes the stand to accuse someone of a crime, the two people involved in the dispute must stand in the presence of the Lord before the priests and the judges who are in office. And the judge must make a thorough investigation, and the witness proves to be a liar, giving false testimony against a fellow Israelite, then do to the false witness as that witness intended to do to the other party, and you purge the evil from among you. There was no turning state's evidence in a Jewish court. If these guys had set it up so she could be caught in the act, that made them, I won't get the legal term right here, they were co-conspirators, or they were participants before, during, or after the fact of the crime. So under the provision of Deuteronomy 19, could they bring this woman to court and testify that she was caught in the act of adultery and therefore should be put to death? Only if they were willing to be examined and if they were participants, liars, false witnesses, or they'd set it up and were themselves co-conspirators. You see, a couple of days ago, the woman in Oxford, Michigan, I taught in the school building when I was up there where several kids were killed. The mother was convicted of what, second-degree manslaughter, because the kid had warned and he was going to and they didn't secure the... It's sort of this, except not quite as bad. Okay, if any one of you didn't have any participation in the sin that this woman is set up for, you go ahead and throw one of the stones and I'll join you. What does the text say? From the oldest to the young ones, they dropped their rocks and went home. The old heads knew they'd been had before the young bucks did. Somewhere along the way, a rabbi had said, now, you know, if you give false testimony, perjured testimony, or if you are a participant in or help commit the crime and you're found out, the penalty that your testimony would bring on this woman would be imposed on you. That cut down some plea bargaining, wouldn't it? They leave. Jesus is alone with the woman. Jesus said, well, I can't condemn you. Why? He'd not been witness to it. So what does he do? He says, next time be more careful. No. He says, lady, you got a break today. You better be glad somebody who'd read the whole book was here when this started. And now that you have a break, go home. Don't ever do that again. That offends God and could get you killed. But how did Jesus handle the holiness code? He didn't revoke it. He said the code stands, but the full code stands. And the code is designed to protect somebody against harm from malicious folks. And so only if you didn't participate in setting this up could you cast a stone. They all were privy. And when he gave her grace, then he confronted her with the truth. You know what you did was wrong. Circumstances behind it for the moment, not really my issue. Don't do it again. Jesus handled the holiness code by first being defensive out of grace to try to protect her if he could, and then to challenge her to walk in what was holy. That's how we ought to treat persons who are dealing with same-sex issues. The queer jokes, the God hates fag signs, this is the worst of all sin. Gender dysphoria. Kids in this church, I'm sure, deal with. I hope they talk to their parents, not another kid at school who doesn't know any more than they do, or who's got a, you know, the gingerbread person to show them and say, well, that's to be expected. Here's what we need. Here's what we're going to do. No. Social contagion, the public pressures from athletes, from musicians, from entertainers, and from the larger culture, from like the one I read you about, the school teacher who's got about 37th grade girls convinced, well, you know, I've felt some of that, and I've wondered about that, so I guess I am too. First thing we do is we show defensive grace, and then we take our honorable stand still on what is true. Tall order. But to be one of God's people is not easy. It's called discipline, discipleship. But that is the call to us. Thanks for being here. We'll pick it up. Next week, here's where we go. We'll talk about the culture over the next 2 weeks. Well, not next week, it's Ash Wednesday. Next two sessions are about the culture within which the Bible was written. What kind of moral code was being lived in that culture? Okay? Thanks for being here. Good night.